Welcome to the Extensive Reading Podcast, where we take an intensive look at extensive reading. I'm Travis Past, along with me.
And I'm Jose Camino.
And here for the 26th episode, we are interviewing Amanda Gillis Furutaka,
who's a professor in the Foreign Languages Department at Kyoto Sangyo University, which is, by the way, where we're recording this episode. And we're very thankful to them. We're using a very nice studio that we've used in the past to interview Tom Robb. And yeah, thanks a lot for that. I've been wanting to interview Amanda Gillis Furutaka for a long time. I read an article she wrote for the Journal of Extensive Reading in 2014 on graded readers and readability.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really, really inspiring, and I wish there were more research into that. And there's a link to a different episode. In episode 11, we interviewed Aaron Campbell along with Kevin Ransdom, and when we asked Aaron how he got involved with extensive reading, he mentioned that he used to work at Kyoto Sangyo University with some of the big names, and those big names were Tom Robb and Amanda Gillis Furutaka.
Yeah, she's been teaching here at Sangyo since 1993, but even before that, she was in Brazil, and I think she taught 5 years there. And even before that, she was teaching in China.
So yeah.
So she's been doing this for a long time, and definitely has been a key player in the extensive reading program here at Sangyo. So I'm sure she'll have a lot of interesting things to share with us.
Yeah, this last episode we talked about research and possible avenues of research into extensive reading. And there's something special about Amanda's research, and that she's been doing qualitative research with interviews with students and trying to get to the bottom of what their experiences with extensive reading are. And yeah, that's one of the things we'll be talking about.
Yeah, and especially their use of their first language while they're reading, how often they're translating in their head, why they're translating, and I think that's...
And whether that is a good thing or a bad thing.
Up for debate. Yeah, we'd meant to do this a year ago.
Right, yeah.
My apologies for not following up as soon as I ought to.
We're here now.
But you've been teaching here since 1993.
Yes.
Right? Is that the...
my 25th year.
Wow. Mm. Awesome. Is that the origin of when you started or became interested in extensive reading at the same time, or was it even before then?
I think in reality, it was when I was at high school. Because I'm from the UK, and when we are 16, we have to choose, in my day, we had to choose three subjects to study for advanced level, A level, and they would determine the kind of university course you would enter. And I really loved languages, and so I chose French, German, and English.
Hmm.
And for the French and German courses, we had to read literature in the original version. And so it was very challenging. It wasn't extensive reading because it was above our level, but it encouraged me to read much more in that language and to encounter such a much wider range of vocabulary and also syntactic structures. I think that was the beginning. I didn't appreciate it so much at the time. When I got to university, I decided to major in French with German as my second language. And we had to read and read and read. We read French literature from medieval right through to current 20th century.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And we had to read vast quantities, and I noticed that it was getting easier and easier. Even though I was reading such old texts a lot of the time, I was no longer needing to think in English. I could just read it directly in French. And because I didn't study German so much, I didn't read so much in German. And my German is far less developed than my French. But French these days, I can still think in French. I can pick up a novel and enjoy it, reading it directly in French without needing a dictionary. And I think it's because I was able to consolidate my French vocabulary and grammatical structures through that vast amount of reading. And it was when I came across extensive reading in EFL, I thought, well, yes, this is obvious. I know exactly how effective reading a lot is.
Just first-hand experience,
experience, yeah. Yes. And also, it makes so much sense because when you're raising small children, all of your peers and all of the literature tells you to read to your children from before they're even 1 year old, when they're tiny little babies. Just read to them, read them stories. And this is a really good way of building up their vocabulary and sense of the structure of the language. And so with my own children, I was doing that and then teaching them to read, encouraging them to read. And I carried on reading aloud to my younger two sons, who are twins, until they finished junior high school.
Yeah, I remember having lunch with you, and my daughter had just been born, and I said, how did you do it? And you said, every night I would read to him after dinner.
Yes. Well, they're very slow eaters, so I had a captive audience. So while they were sitting there munching away on their dinner, I would read to them, and I made sure it was something exciting, a page-turner kind of book, and we had a great time, and I think it really helped them expand their vocabulary, consolidate their language, And they're both very comfortable in both English and Japanese now.
Mm. That's excellent. I have to try that in Spanish.
Well, to your credit, Jose, whenever I go over to your house, usually in the evening, I see all three of your sons, and they're all holding books.
Yeah, we have them read it. I mean, it's their right. They have the right to a book after a bath, before going to bed.
Right.
Mm. No, I didn't think of doing that during dinner. That's brilliant.
It's a great time.
They. I don't know if they'll manage to start reading by themselves in Spanish anytime soon. But they've developed the ability to listen to stories and to enjoy them.
Spanish. I ought to add that sadly, my sons never got into extensive reading. I really tried to encourage them to read in English, but if there was a Japanese version available, they would go for the Japanese. Mm-hmm. The easy route. We're like water, we flow, take the easy route. Okay.
So let's transition over to the kind of research you've been doing.
Okay, so before I came to this university, Tom Robb had already set up extensive reading as a required course for students. It's been going since 1987 here. And so we already had a course that was extensive reading. And then from 2000, it became a little bit more systematic because we were introducing testing to count the number of words that students were reading. And so a colleague and I and Tom were very much involved with the students on a daily basis, because at that point, the only time that they could take these tests was in the lunch break, because we were using a program produced in the States really for American kids in school. It's called Accelerated Reader. And so they have ready-made tests for hundreds and hundreds of books, which are part of the American education required, or part of what they expect the kids to read. And so we were using those books, and we could add a limited number of our own tests. But because it was very limited, and because we wanted to expand the choice for our students and introduce graded readers rather than teenage literature from America, which wasn't really suitable for extensive reading for our lower level students. Then Tong set up his Moodle Reader, and then that morphed into M-Reader.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved right through, almost from when I first started teaching here. And I could see that some students were really taking to this reading like ducks to water in the same way that I had, and they were blossoming as language students, and others just could never get into it. And this became even more apparent when in 2009 the extensive reading program was expanded to cover all of the students in the university. Because Tom and other believers in extensive reading were on the committee for the general education English program, they managed to persuade the university and the library to cooperate so that we had about 2,500 students doing, more than that, because they had the English department as well, nearly 3,000 students a year doing extensive reading. And so I decided to investigate the reason why some students are really taking to it like ducks to water and why others were never getting off the ground. And so I decided to interview people because we did a survey, a very simple, quick survey of about 2,500 students towards the end of a semester. This was the general education students who had required extensive reading. And we added a few questions at the end of their test. And so we got a very large sample.
Mm-hmm.
And we just basically asked, when you're reading in English, do you translate into Japanese? And the answers clearly, yes. A lot of them were yes, and at different levels of English as well. So I decided to investigate, so what's going on? And so I was lucky that my proposal was accepted by Monkasho for Kakenhi.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a lot of money to be able to carry out interviews in various places with various levels of learners. And so I used my contacts to interview students in junior high, senior high, and then our own university students. And it was really very productive. I discovered so much about how students go about extensive reading and the thought processes while they are reading a text. And so I used a kind of think aloud protocol. And other researchers of reading skills have used what's called a think aloud protocol, mostly for working with high level students who are dealing with a very difficult text. And it requires some training because the subject, the participant in the experiment, has to read the text, like a newspaper article, journal article, and while they're reading it, they have to, in real time, say what they're thinking and how they're grappling with the meaning, how they're working out what it means and sort of summarizing their thoughts. And this is all done, obviously the text is in a foreign language, and they're thinking aloud in their first language. But it does require training because it's not at all a natural process.
No. If you ask me to do aloud, that right yes, now, I think yes. I have a problem doing that.
Yeah. So I was going to be working with young kids, first year junior high, 12, 13 years old. And even university students are not that mature. And so I couldn't spend time training. I decided to use a much simpler method, which I call retrospective, think aloud. So I asked them to read the story and then to summarize what they'd read in Japanese or English, whichever they preferred. And then I asked them to use a color highlight pen and just go through the story again and just mark the places where they remember switching into Japanese for some reason, whatever reason. And then we went through the text, and each place they had highlighted, that I asked them to explain to me in English or Japanese what was going on. Yes, why they had thought in Japanese, translated into Japanese. And it seemed to be, it seemed to work very well.
Kind of like a recall then.
It is. It was recalling. Yes. Yeah. And so that's why it's retrospective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It seems far less intrusive than, I mean, if it were, if they were telling you what they are doing at the time they are reading, then the L one would be interfering.
All the time. And they would lose the flow of what they were reading as well. Yeah. They couldn't possibly follow a story. And the flow of what they were reading was being interrupted so much anyway, as I discovered through this, when they were explaining to me why they had highlighted. I mean, one of the first junior high school boys that I interviewed, he really kept checking with me. You want me to highlight everything every place where I thought in Japanese? I said, yes. Are you sure? Everything I thought, yes. So he got the pen, he just highlighted everything. Two words he didn't highlight were and but.
That's something else.
It wasn't and but, it was but and something else, because he hadn't learned them yet. And so because he hadn't learned them, he hadn't translated into Japanese, but everything else he had translated into Japanese. And when I asked him, so why did you translate into Japanese? He said, well, I'm not confident I understand it if I can't translate it into Japanese. Yeah, so it was a confidence thing, that was going on with him. And he was coming towards the end of his first year of formal English study in a junior high school.
It's probably not unusual at all here.
No, not unusual at all. No, I think he was pretty representative of a lot of his classmates. Yeah.
Well, Jose, you should know, you spent years teaching at that level, right?
At junior high school, and doing extensive reading for about 3 years.
Right.
Yeah, it's not easy, of course, and... There's this thing called Yakudoku, which for some reason we haven't talked about in the podcast yet, and it's a technique of reading that.
Well, I asked him, does your teacher ask you to do this? And he said, no, I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not, and especially in the public high schools now, the teachers are not encouraging them to translate in junior high school. That is, they're not encouraging them to translate. They are in juku. Much more.
Yeah.
But they're much more progressive now in the public junior high. And when I asked them, so a lot of the students that I interviewed in public junior high were also going to juku. And I asked them, so which is more interesting, the high school classes or the juku classes? They said, oh, the junior high classes, because we play games and it's much more fun. But the juku, it's Benkyo and testing, yes, and yakudoku.
But I'm really I'm not surprised that yakudoku isn't something you need to teach. I think as soon as you have an L1, everything is processed through that.
Exactly.
So it's entirely
this
natural.
Is what I came to understand through my research, that yes, and thinking back on my own experience when I was reading novels, both in high school and at university, when I was reading all this stuff, I was reading directly in French, but I was writing my notes in English. We had to write our exam questions in English, and I would be thinking about the characters and the plot in English, although I had read it in French. So it was stored in my memory in English, and this is something I came across when I was interviewing a balanced bilingual young woman, and she alerted me to this, and then I went off and checked with other bilingual kids that, we do everything in one language in class, but then afterwards we realize that when we're recalling it, we're recalling it in the stronger language.
It's all stored in one.
Mm.
So you're touching now on aspects that are not quite, not just translation, like the use of the...
It's use of memory, long-term memory, yes.
Could you tell us about these other uses of the first language while reading in a second language, besides translation?
Okay. So when I was going through the texts with students, at low level, it was very often where, especially use of syntax that for them was still difficult to process. For example, relative clauses and relative pronouns, pronouns in general, they always wanted to look back and check what it was referring to, and conditional sentences, even the sort of intermediate, more advanced level students were not confident if with conditional sentences. They weren't confident they got the meaning until they had translated it. And okay, right, now I've got it. And that was so with high school students and some of the university students. Yeah. So grammatical structures. Yeah. They need to think it through. And then very interestingly, when they're reading the stories, from time to time, there was one young girl who was she was a first-year junior high school student, but she was a sophisticated reader. She was reading the story The Shoemaker and the Elves, which is a cyclical story. And I noticed that she'd highlighted the same points in the text throughout. So I said, well, why did you highlight these points, these repetitive points in the text? And she said, well, because I started to notice a pattern. And first of all, the elves left one coin, and then the next time they left two coins. And so I was confirming the pattern of the story in Japanese in my head. And so she was summarizing, mm-hmm. and just storing, and so she could make predictions about what was going to happen next. And that was really interesting. And she was very aware that she was doing that. Yeah. So
it was a strategy she was using.
It was a strategy she was using. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And also that same student, when she was looking at the questions, I gave them some comprehension questions, just to check how much they had understood. In fact, towards the end of the experiment, I gave up using the comprehension questions because I found that just asking them to summarize verbally was more effective, because sometimes my questions were harder than the story.
Yeah.
But anyway, she found my questions quite hard. She was one of the early people I interviewed. And I noticed that she had written Japanese translations
on
the keywords, keywords of the questions,
and
the content words of the questions. So I came to this and I said, well, why did you do this? And she said, well, it helps me remember the question. So because a long and difficult sentence is difficult for them to pass directly in the L2, they're using these, she used like external memory hooks to help her to get to the full meaning of the sentence, of the question in this case. Yeah. So, yeah, external memory.
Yeah, you mentioned that I think your more recent paper, just about how, I mean, working memory is already limited.
Yes.
And so just the use of external memory to just write down gists.
Yes.
Or
yes.
summaries, yes. or in that example, like keywords to help trigger things.
That's right, yes. Yeah, so gists is a word used by Sosa to explain the reading process, how unconsciously we summarize as we go along. And this young woman, when I asked her, maybe she'd never thought about it before until I'd asked her to highlight where she thought in Japanese, but she was probably unconsciously creating gists in Japanese as she went through the story and recognized the pattern and started to predict what was going to happen next.
That's interesting, because I think there's such a strong attitude that, you know, everything should be done in the L2 when you're learning in L2. And I remember one of my first jobs in Japan was at an Eikaiwa. Mm. And my favorite student was this older gentleman, probably in his late 70s, a math teacher. And he came in and we had a private lesson. And he would do that like out loud as he was reading. He would make a gist or a summary in Japanese as he was parsing sentences. Mm. And he had been studying English for years.
Mm.
And his English level was really high, but like it almost became a hindrance for him.
Mm.
But so I'm like, oh, well, he shouldn't do that. I really encouraged him just to use the L2, just to use English. But then, I mean, looking back on the other hand, it's like, well, even if balanced bilinguals do this naturally, they're more proficient at it.
Yeah.
But why should we expect other learners to do anything differently?
Yes.
Probably not.
No. I think we'd be very foolish to command them to stop thinking in your first language. Yeah. And there was, it was very interesting because there are certain points where students identified they couldn't prevent the first language from jumping in.
Sure.
So, for example, if they're reading a text and then there's a number on the page, they'll be reading it in English in their head. You know how I talk about this a little bit later in my more recent paper, how when we're reading, we hear what we're saying.
What we're reading. Yeah.
And so they were reading and hearing English in their head, but then suddenly they saw like number 2 or 300 and it would be Japanese because their brain would just process it in Japanese and they would suddenly have Japanese.
It's impossible not to.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and also with place names, yes, they would be reading it and then they would see London, but in their heads they would hear Rondon. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So those things which are so automatic in the first language, it's impossible to switch off. Yeah. Yeah. They said it was really, really hard. So you can't switch it off.
Mm. I'm just thinking of my own experiences.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because
you're bilingual, English, Japanese.
Oh, no, my Japanese is far from...
Sorry, English,
Spanish.
English, Spanish, yeah. I meant English, Spanish.
Well, it depends on the definition of bilingual. I'm pretty functional in in English.
You do all right, Jose.
Yeah. I was just wondering whether I'm structuring your discourse now in Spanish.
at all. Right.
I don't think I am, though.
You're following it in English, but maybe later when you think about it, you'll reflect on it in Spanish. It
might be the case. I'm quite skeptical, I have to say.
Really? Well, good.
No, it's that was a bit surprising when I read your article, the experience of the more advanced students.
Right.
And yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised to read that there was this need to structure, however subconsciously, the text with reference to the first language.
Yeah. I think there are two factors there. One is the bilingual young people I interviewed, so these were high school students. They definitely, Japanese was their dominant language because they were living in Japan. Mm-hmm. And one parent was an English speaker. And although they were in international school, or the first young woman was in a Japanese high school, but she spends an awful long time in English speaking circles because she's a swimmer. And she enters international competitions. And so, she feels she's very balanced bilingual, but then she recognizes that Japanese is her dominant language. Mm-hmm. And the others were similar. They were either completely Japanese or with one parent that was non-Japanese, but they were in international school, but nevertheless living in Japan. So possibly we couldn't say they're equally balanced bilinguals. Yeah, but... it depends how strong you are and also how the field of the topic that you're talking about or thinking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, because very often you'll hear bilinguals say, well, I can talk so much better about English language teaching in English because that's what I do. But any other thing, politics or philosophy, I want to talk in the other language because that's the language that I've read about and discussed these things in. So, yeah, it's very much... and, I mean, my Japanese is by no means fluent, but I can talk very much more fluently about childbirth and pregnancy and childhood illnesses than I can about politics in Japanese because I've just lived through those experiences and that's just where I've had my most practice.
Yeah, my best Japanese is concerning food, right?
Oh, right.
You have trouble in English?
I'm pretty good at cooking too and recipes,
I'm just better at ordering it. Really fluent in that regard.
Yeah. I have trouble with things that are things of the house, household chores in English. Like you do your laundry and then you put the clothes to dry.
Out to dry?
Because your wife is Japanese, right? And I imagine she...
It's just that it's something I've never done in English. I've never
You've never had to talk about
I've
it in
never,
English.
Yeah, I've never lived in a family where that was done in English. So I can my Japanese is nowhere near my English, but
in that sense,
in that particular case, I can.
You can say that in Japanese.
I know the words. I feel much more confident talking about the laundry.
you hear it when your wife uses that and to your children, and then you could use that with your children in Spanish, but you just never use that in English, right?
That's right. There's no need for English there. Whereas in terms of like the academia or extensive reading, it always feels lame to have to translate everything into Spanish to be able to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in English.
So I totally see what you mean about topics and
depending on fields. Okay.
Well, I think we've covered kind of number four, qualitative studies.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you've done a lot of qualitative research, kind of as we've been talking about with
in extensive reading, and also in my research in music as well.
Sorry, let me interrupt. What is qualitative research?
Okay, so basically there are two styles of research, quantitative and qualitative. And quantitative is often carried out with surveys or with experiments. If it's with experiments, you have the group that is treated, that receives special treatment, and you have a control group. And then you measure their progress, and then you compare and analyze and discuss reasons why one group will have performed differently to the other group. You begin with a hypothesis, and then you test the hypothesis. You're trying to prove your hypothesis wrong. Qualitative research doesn't come from the field of science, and it's not based on data. I forgot to mention about the survey style. So the experimental style and survey style of quantitative research. Basically, the experimenter comes up with a set of questions, and then we'll ask as large a number of people as possible to answer the questions, and then we'll analyze the results. This is fine, but I feel it's rather limited, especially the survey style, because it really depends on the researcher coming up with the right questions. And what you can deduce from the answers is only relevant to the questions that you asked. You can't make assumptions from the answers of the respondees to your survey. With the experimental style, I feel this is often very dubious because our students, who are usually our research subjects, they are taking usually more than one course in English. And so when you have a control group, an experimental group, you can't control for all variables because they may well be having English with another teacher and learning things that they're not learning in the extensive reading course. So that for me is, there raises lots of questions.
Sure.
Now, qualitative research is a real mouthful to say.
Yeah.
This comes from the fields of anthropology and sociology, and it has a very different worldview. It looks at society and humans and human interaction and human relations. And it's much more fuzzy, but it recognized the complexity of human relations and how this complexity impacts what goes on. And I felt that this would be it would provide far richer insights. Originally, early anthropologists would go and observe communities in the jungle and the prairies, wherever. And once they'd learned the language, then they could interview. Sociologists also conduct observations and conduct interviews one-on-one or pair interviews or focus group interviews. And another approach with this kind of research is looking at texts and analyzing texts. So something that has been written or something written by the participants or written, or analyzing in great detail the language used during an interview. And that's discourse analysis. What I wanted to do was interview a lot of people and then come up with general themes that emerge from the interviews. So that was the kind of research that I planned to do, because my research questions were very broad. They weren't a hypothesis. You, with qualitative research, you start with questions. You don't have a hypothesis. So my first question was, so why are some students doing so much better than others with extensive reading? Mm-hmm. And then, why are some students using Japanese so much when they're reading easy English, which should be their level or lower? Yeah. And then, so what role is working memory playing in reading and a graded reader text? Yes. So these are the questions that I've been asking generally, and then getting lots of surprises, because during the course of interviews, which are not, they are loosely structured, because the researcher has a very clear idea of what kind of areas they want to ask, but you don't have to stick to the script. If the person you're interviewing comes up with something totally new, and then you're free to go off and explore that.
Yeah, follow that.
Yeah. And then follow it up in later interviews, see if the same idea is repeated. Yeah. So that's qualitative. But it's the problem with this kind of research is because it's not numbers. You don't write your results up as tables. There are no charts, no diagrams. It's perfectly acceptable in the world of sociology, and also I did my PhD in music. When you're talking about sociology of music audiences, it's perfectly acceptable to say many people said, very few people said. It's not common. It's very common. This is totally acceptable because the researcher is trusted to have collected a lot of data, analysed it very carefully, and then being able to deduce generalizations. And quoting numbers is kind of meaningless in this kind of writing up, because what you're doing, you're writing up a story.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing a qualitative research report, it should be storytelling rather than reporting a scientific experiment. Yeah.
Well said.
So what's the future of, or what would you see as a nice future for that kind of research,
right,
and extensive reading?
I feel that it brings a nice balance, and it also opens up opportunities for us to discover things that have been overlooked until now. Especially when I was researching the different reasons why students do flip into out of English and into Japanese, I came up with so many things that were unexpected when using famous publishers' graded readers, which I thought would be very reliable. There were so many things that, oh, they overlooked this. Oh, gosh, I bet they didn't think about that. Mm-hmm. And it was quite shocking. And so by just using a different approach and going to the readers themselves and working directly with the readers, we can find out so much more than just using general surveys.
In one of your articles, you mentioned that one student who was reading a graded reader saw an illustration and assumed that the characters were mother and daughter.
Yes, yeah.
And whereas in the story, they were supposed to be sisters.
Yes.
And it would be very hard to find that insight through quantitative research,
yes,
right?
Yes. You wouldn't be able to find that kind of thing out. Yeah. And publishers, I assume, don't have the time and money for large-scale
piloting.
Piloting. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
No problem.
The Spanish speaker came up with a word that I couldn't find in English. Yeah, so I don't think they take the time or spend the money on piloting. But if they'd piloted those books, but also worked individually with students to get their feedback, they would have discovered that. I mean, in that same story, there was an example of metonymy, which is a sophisticated language use. When publishers are writing these stories, this was a 75-head word story, the lowest level for beginner's readers.
The Girl in Red?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And, yes, so the girl in red, who looked like the mother in the illustration, was wearing a red jacket, but everything else was different colours. And also, the students only had a black and white copy anyway. Yeah, in the original, she is wearing a red jacket. But the girl in red is very easy English. But to make that conceptual leap, they said, why in red? Should it be the girl is red? Or why the girl in red? Yeah, so native speakers, well, of course she's wearing red. Yeah, but they hadn't been taught.
She's not in the red.
No, she's not in the red either. Yes, yeah. Yeah, so...
Okay, yeah. Well, when I read that, I still had a hard time of understanding what you meant there. So that.
Oh, I see. So
no, I understand.
The student couldn't
more
understand.
Now.
Yes, that why this girl was called the girl in red.
In red, yeah.
Yeah, because there was no indication as to what was red.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the red jacket.
In the red jacket. Yes. If it said the girl in the red jacket, they would have understood.
Very
but jacket
clearly,
obviously
yeah.
wasn't among. The 75 head words they could use. So they just cut jacket and the girl in red.
Yeah. When a publisher is considering readability, they focus on head words. But your research has shown that there's a lot more to consider when considering readability.
Yes, yeah.
Could you tell us more about that?
Right. So some expressions which are idiomatic, seem to be simple English but are idiomatic, are very difficult for students to catch. We just talked about the example of the girl in red.
Mm-hmm.
Other examples, not idiomatic, but the use of pronouns. There's when there's more than one pronoun in a sentence, and it's very difficult for students to work out which pronoun is referring to which reference, and they need to stop and then analyze and go back. And it interrupts the flow. So I would encourage publishers to use fewer pronouns and just to go with a complete phrase. And also... There seems to be a mismatch between the level of the language and the level of inference that the reader was expected to make. There's a problem because graded readers, at the lowest level, they're written for much younger readers, which is natural. But they quickly progress in sophistication. And so... not just cultural assumptions and cultural background knowledge or life background knowledge. By the time you're getting up to the B1, B2 level, some of the readers are still very young and they're still teenagers and they don't have life experience yet that helps them to understand and make inferences from about what is happening, what the characters are thinking, what they're feeling. And it becomes very challenging. It's not just the language, but it's the level of sophistication of the narrative. And some examples were some of the high school students, when I was asking them to read the B1, B2, C1 level stories, they understood all of the vocabulary. That was not a problem. They hadn't highlighted any, well, only two or three words that they hadn't known. But they just didn't get it because there was a twist in the story. There was an unexpected turn of events or there was a flashback included. And the flashback wasn't marked enough within the narrative for them to realize this is going back in time or we're back now in current time. And they just got lost. And so they'd read the story, they'd understood the words, they hadn't understood the story. So I think that publishers need to bear in mind that a lot of their higher level readers are still young readers. And that if when they are telling a story in a graded reader, they have to tell the story in a chronological way. And they do have to make sure that they're explaining the motivations of the characters very clearly. Spell it out more obviously than you would for someone who's reading that story and it's in their first language.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're probably sophisticated readers in their first language, but it's just too much to process when they're reading in a second or foreign language.
One of the main benefits of extensive reading is gaining fluency, automaticity in those lower level
exactly.
reading processes. And
yeah.
so it's still probably difficult to engage in like higher level thinking.
Right. And
they're still reading the lines and not in between them.
That's right.
Right.
Yes. And I can understand why the publishers feel the need to make the story interesting, because you do
Certainly.
Want to keep the
yeah.
readers reading. But if it's a good story, then, and if the characters are compelling, then just spelling things out a little bit more obviously, because it's a graded reader, would keep the readers reading just as much, I think.
Mm.
Rather than them expecting them to be able to read between the lines when they're reading in a second language or foreign language. Mm.
That has to do with your studies with working memory, right?
Yes. So, and this automaticity as well. So in my more recent research, since about 2011-12, I've become more and more interested in neuroscience and what neuroscience can tell us about how the brain works and how the brain reads and how the brain learns to read. And this has helped give me a lot of insight into the process, and especially about automaticity. And I talk in my most recent article about embodiment and try to explain this idea about embodiment, and that how does our brain derive meaning from something? How does our brain derive meaning from shapes on a page? And obviously, the reading process, we go through stages. First of all, when you're reading, learning to read in your first or a foreign language, you have to start recognizing the shapes and then matching the shapes to sounds and then matching those sounds to the words that you know already in the language, and then being able to read a string of them and being able to follow and create a meaning. So adding the syntax. So how do we actually create meaning in our brains from symbols, which then we hear as sounds in our heads? I think everybody agrees that when we read, although we're reading silently, inside we have this little mental voice going on. Sometimes it switches off.
Yeah, I try to switch it off sometimes, just out of like trying to.
And sometimes
it
does, it switches off.
Yeah.
When it switches off, we're seeing a movie going on. And this happens a lot when we're reading fiction, I think. Non-fiction, we hear the voice a lot more, I think. But when we're reading fiction, then we have this movie in our head. And it was very interesting, because talking to students, asking them, so at what point were you able to stop thinking in Japanese and just have a movie going on in your head while you read in English? And it was generally when they reached B2, C1 level in CFR. So really high intermediate, they were able to do that and sort of see what was going on, like a movie in their head. And this is called like embodied simulation. And what happens is that when we automatically process a word and its meaning, in our brain, the meaning actually comprises so many different things. It's our experiences of that thing, images of that thing, and our knowledge of that thing. And so all of this knowledge and this experience have come to us originally through our senses. And so when we are thinking and reading, it's not just one area of our brain that is active, but actually all of our brain is active because all of the connections that we have are firing away. And so this is how we are able to deduce meaning. In my more recent article, I quote Benjamin Bergen, who gives a really, for me, very vivid example. He gives a sentence of the polar bear. The polar bear was sliding along on its belly, jaws agape, about to pounce on the prey. And everybody, when they read that, we're all engaging our knowledge of polar bears and their environment. And although there's no mention of snow or ice, I'm sure when you read that or hear me saying that...
Yeah, I was there.
You were there. Yep. You could see the snow, the ice. You could see this polar bear, which was white, scooting along on its stomach, and then probably a red mouth opening up about to grab the seal. So, yeah, we're engaging all of those parts of our brain that are related to our knowledge of polar bears. And so that's why it's called embodied. It's the whole body is working out the meaning, yeah. And so that's embodied comprehension and embodied simulation, simulating, creating this sort of scene within our mind, in our mind.
In our mind,
yes,
you
know. Yeah. Mentally creating the scene and then understanding it in that way.
And going back to just something that we just briefly mentioned earlier, I think it's really interesting. So that goes through your working memory, and maybe the images are just stored in your long-term memory.
Yeah.
And then how you recall that, whether it's going to be through whichever language is fascinating. What language do you choose to retrieve that in?
Yeah.
I don't know, interesting.
Yeah, where is it stored and how is it stored, in what form? Yes.
And if it's just an image, you probably fall back on your L1 then, if you want to talk about it. I don't know.
You would probably, yes, because probably you would use your L1 because that if it's an image, then you would kind of automatically...
Or whoever your interlocutor is, whatever language that is.
Yes, I think it depends on what language, yes, you're also being required to use.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, well, talking a little bit more about working memory. So working memory is a really important part of the process of reading. And what I found with my research was that very clearly, when beginner readers are reading in English, English L2 readers are reading in English, their working memory is really working over time. And there's a really limited storage capacity. And so, for example, the young woman who was creating gists of the story and then kind of storing them in Japanese, she was easing up the space for her working memory so that she could process what was coming next in English.
Using just that external memory is what
exactly.
You call that, right?
Yes, yeah. And using the L1 as the storage place for, as you work through in the L2. So what is interesting is that our L2 working memory capacity seems to expand the greater the automaticity. The more fluent we become in the language, the more fluent we become as a reader of that language, the more we can retain in our working memory at a time. And so I think the teachers need to be aware of this and not demand that their students only function in the L2, that give them a chance to think in the L1, store it in their working memory in the L1. So that they can recall it later. I think that's a really important stage.
This goes for what you were saying with your experience at the Eikawa.
Yes,
your elderly gentleman was doing just that. And of course, the older we get, the less we can store in our working memory as well. Our working memory becomes less efficient as well. And so especially in an L2. And so he was doing exactly the right thing for his memory. He probably knew himself very well and knew how he worked.
I got to give that guy a call, man. I got his phone number. I see him every once in a while. He's always good to meet me for dinner.
I think in this working memory framework is a very good one to bear in mind when explaining the advantages of extensive reading. The more extensive reading you do, the more words are going to become
automatized.
Yeah. So
therefore,
But and we tend to talk about this in terms of vocabulary only. But I think the deep grammar.
Yes, absolutely.
The fact that
collocations.
And but not only that, it's just the fact like grammatical structure which we have unconsciously stored in our minds, you know.
Yeah.
And
you're drawn on Chomsky, right?
Yeah, that's it. And but not only Tom Robb mentioned the other day the fact that the more you do extensive reading, your ability to predict what's coming next is going to develop. Like if you see a verb, you know that an object is likely to pop up very soon. You know,
or if you see certain verbs, you know that a certain preposition is going to come next.
That's right. Yeah. That would be that would be a different level, though. That would be that the one I mentioned was more on the
more
core
lower level, right?
Yeah,
right.
And then that would have to do with collocation or with subcategorization, like the fact that whenever you use depend. On depend follows, on. And for native speakers of Spanish, not off, on. that would be
more high level.
At the beginning, you have to remember that, you have to monitor that, so you have to use your working memory to keep that in mind, whereas the more you do extensive reading, that becomes automatic, and it no longer takes up working memory space. Mm. Well, thanks, Professor Gillis Rotaka. That was fantastic.
That was amazing. I was really interested in everything she had to say. I'm sure you heard when I was interested because I said something during the interview. But I thought just the use of when you switch back to L1 or how you store things in your long-term memory. Or even when she was talking about embodied simulation and just picturing things as an image while we read, it was fascinating.
I haven't read anything about embodied simulation before. It's like this is my first acquaintance with it. And I have to say I'm a little bit skeptical. Like you figure, like you represent in images in your head. According to the theory, you represent in images in your head what you're reading. And in terms of reading fiction, this seems very natural.
Yeah.
But if you're reading something else, like, a formal document or something at work that has to do with working hours or, I'm not sure how to, I can't really see how we would do that.
When I read her article preparing for this interview, was it?
were you visualizing every?
No, thing? Probably not. Certainly some things, but...
But it's a good avenue to do research on, I think.
Yeah.
Definitely. I really liked the... I think it was very clear the way she explained the differences between different types of research and even differences between quantitative research, survey style and experiments. And that was pretty clear.
Very clear. Very clear. Yeah, and I think... as we said at the beginning of this episode, this was kind of a shift away from the quantitative interviews we had with the past few episodes. So I think it'll be, I hope you listeners enjoyed a different perspective on the kinds of things that can be done.
We're going to leave links to Amanda Gillis Rotaka's articles in the show notes for your reference.
Yeah, please check those out if you're interested. I think reading those will give you a lot better idea of some of the topics we were dancing around. So, other than that, if you have any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us at our email address, which is exrpodcast@gmail.com. or, of course, through our website, which is erpodcast.wordpress.com.
Yeah, please leave your comments. We're looking forward to them.
Yep, as always.
And we don't know what's coming next.
No. As we said, I'll be gone for most of August.
No, you've been gone for most of August.
I've been gone for most of August. So we have some leads that we'll chase, but we'll see where those take us. Look forward to hearing from us again in the fall.
Sure.
And until then.
Yes. Happy reading.